From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 74 with guest Paul Randall, recorded Wednesday, August 27th, 2008. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com.
You're listening to Run As Radio. I'm your host, Richard Campbell. With me, as always, my co-host, Greg Hughes.
Hey, everybody. Richard, how you doing?
I am well, sir. And you?
Doing good. Doing good. Looking forward to having another great conversation related to something SQL Server.
Oh, yes. You know, without a doubt. There's no other way to go about it. And summer's finally over. We're into the fall.
Yeah, it's real nice. It was a good summer. Had an opportunity to do a lot of fun stuff and kind of back into conference season again, aren't we?
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah. October, November, December. It's going to be just madness for us, but in a good way.
And in November, we will be in Barcelona once again.
Yes. Barcelona, Tech Ed, Speaker Idol, the whole nine yards. Said, hey, you want to be a part of Speaker Idol and you're going to be at Tech Ed in Barcelona? Send us an email, info@runasradio.com. I got inside connections. I can make it happen.
Can we judge it again?
Would you like to be a judge, Paul?
Yeah.
I'd love for you to be a judge. We'll work it on the schedule. It's always fun to have you judging, too. You guys are great. You and Kim both, great speakers, and I think you give good feedback to the speaker.
Give excellent feedback, yeah.
And speaking of Paul Randall, guess who our guest is this week?
Hello.
Paul Randall.
It's me.
It's you again.
It is me again. Wow, deja vu. Feels like we just did this.
It's just like that. So you're the managing director of SQL Skills, but you used to have a real job.
I used to have a real job, yes, before I became management. No, I'm kidding. I used to work at Microsoft. I was at Microsoft for 9 years. If you want the whole story, listen to the show a couple of times ago, because, you know, I'm not going to repeat myself.
Yeah, you bet. And certainly DBCC, but you even go back further than that. You were a VMS guy at one time, too.
I used to be responsible for the Open VMS file system and the analyze/disk, which was the equivalent of CheckDisk for the VMS file system.
Right.
Cool.
Good old days.
Well, and I bring that up because our topic today is this whole file stream feature in SQL 2008, which I know is all about managing disks well.
Yes. Yes. A lot of it comes... Well, okay. Well, kind of.
Kind of, sort of, yeah.
Well, let's start at the beginning. Because in the beginning, I was a big advocate of not storing big unstructured data in databases. I thought it was just a mistake.
Why?
The whole blob thing, because they were slow, they were cranky. Yep.
Performance stuff.
Know, it just...
Performance sucked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would rather store a reference to a file in a string in a database and then go see if I can find the file.
It's funny you should say that, because that's basically what FileStream does.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
I'm trying to sound surprised, Paul. Come on.
No. Yeah. the whole problem that FileStream solves is how do you keep your structured and your unstructured data synchronized, but still have high performance for your unstructured data?
Right.
So in other words, how do you have like a database of large video clips and still be able to stream the video clips from your web server efficiently? And storing a large blob inside SQL Server, it does not perform very well.
Right.
As you just said, and we all know if you ever tried it.
But I would like to have the transactional integrity, all of those nice things that I get with SQL Server around these big blobs too.
Right. So until SQL Server 2008, you can't really do that. There's no way unless you kind of roll your own system to do it yourself. And then the transactional integrity is incredibly hard to do if you have a crash, because how do you make the structured data in the database synchronized with the unstructured data that's in the file system or the file other kind of remote blob storage system?
Recovery can be real difficult that way.
Yeah, it's almost impossible.
And you're telling me 2008 solves this?
2008 solves that and more.
And more. Well, I love it.
Solves it and more. I am not on the pay of the SQL marketing team. No, FileStream is actually a pretty cool feature, and I actually just wrote a 30-page white paper on FileStream for the SQL team that should be published before PASS. So by November, that should be published.
Excellent.
And that the white paper deals with setting up a system for FileStream, why you'd want to use FileStream in the first place, and some of the kind of performance gotchas. It doesn't deal with how you go about programming to use FileStream, because I'm not a developer anymore.
That's a different problem, actually, using FileStream.
That's a whole different white paper.
Okay.
So, one of the first things that you need to think about is what are the sizes of your blobs? Okay, and by blobs, we mean a binary large object, something like a photograph or a document or a video stream, something like that. So there was a research paper that the late lamented Jim Gray and a couple of others did a couple of years ago called To Blob or Not to Blob, storing files in the database or in the file system. And the upshot of their research was if the blob is 256K or less, then it's better to store it inside the file system. Inside the database. If it's 1 meg or larger, it's better to store it on the file system. And right. the bits in between are a bit of a gray area, depending on what you want to do. So if you're gonna store lots of very small things like widget icons, then you shouldn't be looking at FileStream. But if you're storing lots of things like videos, then you do want to use something like FileStream, okay? Especially if you want to keep the metadata around the videos or the blobs in sync with the actual files themselves. So that's the first thing. Is FileStream actually right for you?
Right.
So, you know, I mean, a lot of times, the SQL Server team are very cool, okay? And they put all these new features out. Some new features, some, you know, catching up with other RDBMSs. But they have all these cool new features, and they don't give very much guidance on when you should use them, when you shouldn't use them, what the different combinations are that work, that don't work, what the gotchas are, and so on and so on. So that's what these white papers and, I guess, you know, shows like this help to do is give a little bit of guidance around the how you go about doing things and whether you should in the first place kind of thing.
And a megabyte is not that big. So as soon as we're dealing with anything that's a reasonably high-res image or any kind of video, we're going to blow through a megabyte.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And so, I mean, up until now, I've always stored that independently of the database. If I'm going to store it through the file stream, is it really stored in the database still?
No. So the way that it works is, let's walk through actually creating some file stream data.
Okay.
Right. So the very first thing you do is set up your system for file stream, and let's put that aside and we'll talk about that later on in the show. So you create a database that has a file stream file group. Okay, so you either create the database from scratch that has this, or you add another file group to the database. And you specify that this file group is for storing file stream. So nothing actually gets created in the database. What gets created is a directory structure on whatever file path you've said when you create this file group.
Interesting.
That is called a file stream data container.
Okay.
And that's basically going to be a hierarchical tree of directories and files that stores all the actual file stream data. Now, the file stream files themselves have generated names, and the generated name is actually stored in the row in the table that relates to that bit of data. And so if you do a select back from the table that has a file stream column, it will actually go out to the file stream file, open the file, and suck the information back into SQL Server.
Cool.
Okay, so that's the T-SQL way of accessing the data. So the Win32 way of accessing the data would be you have to connect to the database first and get a transaction context. And right. Then you can use that transaction context to get a path name to the file stream file that you want. And then you say, okay, I want to use the open file Win32 API, and you specify that you're opening this particular file. There's a file system filter driver that's installed when you enable FileStream that catches that open file request and makes sure that you've got the right security context to be able to do that, and then allows you to go and open the file. And then you can read information out of the file using the regular Win32 APIs.
So you can, I always had a sense that once it was inside of the file stream, the only way to get to it was the database, but there are ways to get to it directly.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's really the whole point of file stream is that you don't have to go through the database to get the information back.
Right.
Because if you think about it, the data is all stored out in the file system. If you were to access it through SQL Server itself, then all that file stream data would have to be read into the SQL Server buffer pool and then streamed out through whatever protocol you're using back to your client.
Right.
Okay, so it has to take a trip through memory. By using Win32 APIs, you're just directly accessing the file itself, and it doesn't have to bounce through memory at all.
Yeah. No, it's logical, but that means there is no penalty here. If you know how to do this properly, it's going to work just as if it was a regular file system file, except that it also has the advantages of being SQL Server.
It has the advantage that you can tie it into the structured data as well in a transactionally consistent way.
Right.
So now, there are some gotchas.
There's
a bunch of different gotchas that you have to be careful of. Okay. One of the most interesting ones is, I guess, there's no such thing as a partial update to this file stream data. When you create, if you have a very large file stream file and you want to alter a couple of bytes, so you've got a 10 gig file stream file, you want to alter a couple of bytes in the file. It creates an entire new 10 gig file with your 2 bytes in.
Ah.
It doesn't just go and alter the existing one.
And then throws the old one away.
It eventually throws the old one away. It has to keep the old one around until the transaction obviously has completed, because a rollback might need the old file back.
Right.
And it also has to keep it around so that you can back it up as part of backing up the transaction log. Because the cool thing about FileStream is, in the file system, it has its own log as well. There's a FileStream log, which lives in the directory structure inside this FileStream data container. And so when you do a backup, it actually backs up all the relational data with the log, plus all of the FileStream data with its log. So you can actually do point-in-time recovery.
That's very cool.
Yeah, and you can do restore with stop at.
But I also get the sense that what you're telling me is you're going to use way more disk space than you thought possible.
Well, no, not necessarily, because if you're storing a 10 gig image file, say, or a 10 gig video file, say, that's more likely, 10 gig video file, then in the database, it's going to store 10 gig plus the overhead of having to chunk it up into database pages and so on and so on.
Yep.
In the file system, you're going to store as a 10 gig file.
Yes.
So you could actually, you know, you could actually make the argument you're going to use less space, because you don't have the overhead of having to chunk it up and store it in the database.
Well, but the price here is that if I alter that file a couple of times, I'm going to end up with several copies of it until the transaction log gets backed up.
Right. So one of the kind of early best practices, because this feature has only been there, SQL Server was only released a month ago, but it's been. Can I help you? 4 days. Kimberly is actually sitting here with me in the office. We're not letting her speak, though, because she's a, kind of disgusting snot ball. She's got kind of feeling well. Can't talk.
She's not feeling well. Yeah. That's the nice way you talk about your wife.
It's
she's not feeling
well. And she's a disgusting snot ball. But anyway, I was saying, what was I saying? Oh, yeah, I remember what I was saying. So one of the early best practices is if you are going to do a bunch of partial updates to a file, chunk them up, okay? Gather them up into one big update.
Right.
Queue them up.
Do one update, okay? So you could have your own, say, var binary max column that you bunch up all these different updates, and then when you reach a certain threshold, go and kind of flush them out to your file stream data.
Right, out all your changes at once.
Getting around that.
And then you only get one additional copy of that your big file.
Right. So you might then say, okay, so you've got these other copies of the file. When do they go away? So there's a thing called garbage collection. Just in the same way, kind of the same way that garbage collection and managed code works.
Right.
Every so often, the garbage collector will get rid of all the files that are no longer needed. And the garbage collector for FileStream works as part of the database checkpoint process. So once checkpoint has run and the files are no longer needed for a log backup, they can be safely got rid of.
Right. So the usual time that files are going to disappear is sometime after that log backup, wherever that may be. It might be a while.
Yeah, so, and there's actually another thing you can do. You can actually have remote access to this data as well. You can specify a file share, a Windows share, and you can access it using the same mechanism as you would for Win32 access, but do it over a remote path, a UNC path.
Nifty. So, I mean, it's a shareable space. All right. So the thing you skipped over here was prepare your machine for file streams.
Okay. All right. So let me see. Where to start? So the very first thing you've got to do is decide whether it's the right thing for you, right thing to store the data in or not. So we've got past that, and we're going to use FileStream. So then you've got to set up the hardware. Okay. So you're looking at what's the RAID level that you want to use. Okay. So if you're going to have a lot of FileStream data that changes an awful lot and is write intensive, you don't want to use RAID 5.
No.
Right.
Even though that's what your SAN guy might try and push on you, because it uses the least amount of his disks.
Right. Okay. Fewest number of spindles for the most amount of space.
Exactly. Right. You want to also use, and all the setup is basically around making sure you get the right performance.
Yeah.
You want to make sure you're using an appropriate disk technology. Okay, SCSI versus SATA or IDE. So SCSI is usually faster than SATA. Okay, because it's going to be more expensive.
Right.
Because they're smaller disks and they're running faster. So by running faster, I mean the rotational speed of the disk is usually faster. You can get like 15,000 RPM SCSI drives.
Right.
Right.
You can get 10,000 RPM RTM, SATA drives now.
Yes.
But I don't think they're very common. But anyway, SCSI is going to have higher rotational speed, which means it's going to have lower latency of the disk heads, and it's going to have lower seek times.
And I got to think for something like a stream, rotational performance is going to matter because that increases your overall transfer rate too.
Absolutely. Yeah, the higher rotational speed you've got, probably the faster the burst transfer rate is going to be.
Any opinions as far as direct attached storage versus, say, an iSCSI store?
I don't have any opinions on that.
Okay.
Anything? No, I don't think it makes any difference, really.
Yeah, it's half a dozen, one sticks the other. I was just curious if it really mattered.
Make sure that your transport is up to whatever speeds you want to be able to, you know, pull the data off the drives at.
Sure.
So, you know. And then whichever one of the disk technologies that you choose, if you're using SATA, then make sure it supports NCQ, and if you're using SCSI, make sure it supports what's called CTQ. And that what these technologies allow either of those drives to do is process multiple interleaved IOs concurrently, which you might want to do if you're accessing multiple file streams at once.
Right.
Although for the most part, what you're describing here is just a good idea for any database store.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But what people won't necessarily think about is that they're really just setting up another database, and they've got to do all the same kind of things that they would go through by when they were provisioning hardware for any other database. Okay.
Yeah, and I've heard of NCQ, native command queuing, before, but I haven't heard of CTQ.
CTQ, command tag queuing.
Okay.
It's basically the same thing as NCQ.
So they're directly related, just one's for SCSI, one's for SATA.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me think, what else? So separating out the data containers. So if you have multiple file stream file groups in a database, which you can do quite happily, then don't stick them on the same drives. Just the same way as you wouldn't want to stick multiple data files or data files and log files on the same drive.
Right.
Because if you're trying to access them concurrently, then you're going to cause disk head contention, which is going to slow down your transfer rate.
Any particular reason I would have more than one file stream space?
So you might want to separate the space for different tables.
Okay.
One table that has non-critical data, you might want to have a different container on, say, RAID 5.
Lower reliability configuration.
Lower reliability, and another one on RAID 10, which has, you know, triple mirrored RAID 10.
Does it matter by size? That if I would tend to want to group bigger items in one place, smaller items in another?
Okay, so this is getting into one of the other setups for NTFS, which is, what do you want the cluster size of NTFS to be when you format the drives?
Enormous.
You want it to be as big as possible.
Yeah.
Well, it depends. If you're storing lots of very small files, which is not the design point of FileStream,
no,
then you can leave the default 4K cluster size. But if you're storing blobs that are a meg or larger, then you probably want to have something like 64K.
Yeah, I mean, if everything's a meg or bigger, use the biggest cluster size you lay your hands on.
Absolutely. I mean, that lets your volume size be larger as well.
Yeah, but I mean, in theory, you're wasting some disk space. That's the concern, but you're not wasting that much because your files are so big.
Exactly. The percentage of wasted space per file is minimal. That's also going to help to reduce file system fragmentation as well.
Right.
Now, because if you've got a workload that's doing lots of inserts, deletes, and updates, especially updates because they create entirely new files, then you're going to end up with fragmentation at the NTFS level. And so one of the things before you create a data container on a system that's already been used is defrag the drive. And every so often when you're using FileStream is defrag the drive, you know, just to make sure that fragmentation and having to bounce around on the disk, the disk heads bounce around on the disk to read a single file isn't slowing down your streaming.
So DBC is not going to fix that for me?
Nothing inside SQL Server can affect operating system level fragmentation.
Yeah, I bet you if you were still there, it'd be fixed.
No, not even if I was there. No. there's no way that you can, unless you had a DBCC go out to the operating system and run a file system defrag.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's probably
make sure you're coping fragmentation. And then the two key things is turn off 8.3 name generation.
Okay, it's just not
turn
needed.
Off last access time tracking. So what do I mean by that? So whenever you create a file in an NTFS volume, it generates an 8.3 name, okay, 8 bytes dot 3 bytes name, so that 16-bit apps can still use the files. The problem is that the algorithm to do that, when it generates a new name, it has to make sure there's no collisions. So it goes and scans all the existing names to make sure that it doesn't collide.
Right.
Right? So as soon as you get a large number of files, the performance of inserting and updating drops down an awful lot. Okay? So you need to go out to your drive and use the FSUtility, and you can turn off 8.3 name generation. In fact, I just did a blog post about high-performance file stream tips and tricks on my blog yesterday that has all this kind of stuff that I'm saying, and it's all covered in the white paper as well. So turn that off, and then turn off last access time tracking as well.
Where do we do this? Where would we do this?
Go out to a command prompt and use the fsutil command.
Oh, okay. So this is just all directly done from the command prompt.
Yep.
Excellent.
And you can change. I mean, there's a bunch of different things you can change. You can also use fsutil to do quota management as well. But fsutil, there's a couple of behavior options that you can set that change whether these are enabled or not. So now the one caveat for that is if you do have an application that's got data on that drive as well, if you're sharing the drive of the data container with something else, then turning off that 8.3 name generation affects the entire volume, the entire NTFS volume. So no 16-bit app is going to be able to touch that volume.
Right.
So that could be a bummer for you.
It may or may not be a huge issue. I mean, it depends.
Yeah.
But it's certainly nothing trivial either. But, I mean, are we talking about that substantial a performance gain to have these things switched?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's actually documented. There's Microsoft documentation that says if you're going to have more than, say, 300,000 files in a directory, turn off 8.3 name generation.
Yeah, anyway, not irrespective of...
Anyway, not just because of file stream. Just turn off anyway.
Now, these are just good practices for configuring systems well. And yeah. What's interesting to me is I've never thought about defragmentation of files for SQL Server because it hasn't mattered before. There was only a file.
Well, I wouldn't say it doesn't matter because, you know, I think in the last show that we did, I talked about how SQL Server data files can actually get fragmented, especially if you've got poorly configured autogrow turned on and you're letting autogrow grow the files rather than growing them yourselves.
Right.
And if you've got like very large tables inside very large fragmented files, and you're doing an allocation order scan to even a select star, or you're doing a very large range scan, then again, the disk heads to read in all the chunks of the data file are going to be bouncing around on the disk, and so you're going to be slowing down your scan performance. So it actually does matter. It doesn't matter as much as, say, index fragmentation inside data files, but it does have an effect on performance if the data files themselves are fragmented.
That's huge. All right, so that's our sort of basic configuration things we want to do. Anything else we need to know?
I would say you need to be careful of some of the limitations of FileStream. Okay, limitations in terms of unsupported feature combinations. So here's a massive unsupported feature combination for me. If you have database mirroring installed, you cannot use FileStream. It will just not let you do it.
Wow.
Yeah, if you have FileStream... If you configure your system for FileStream and then you want to add database mirroring afterwards, you can't do it.
Not an option.
They are not compatible.
So you have to use a different backup strategy.
You'd have to use some other kind of HA strategy.
Right.
Okay, like log shipping, for instance, or replication. But you cannot use database mirroring, or clustering, for instance.
Right.
But you cannot use database mirroring. Okay. I personally think that's going to be a big barrier for adoption for many customers for V1, because FileStream is a V1. But I have been promised that will be fixed for the next version of SQL Server.
And you can see why. I mean, mirroring means that they would have to mirror all of the FileStream files as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a lot of extra data that needs to be sent across. So I'm sure they'll come up with some smart way of being able to compress things. Although, you know, even in 2008, LogStream that they send over is compressed. They've added that as a new feature for 2008. The mirroring LogStream that gets sent between the principal and the mirror is actually now compressed by default. It's about the only different feature that's on by default when you upgrade. this is turned on. Well, you know, the team likes to operate on what Dave Campbell calls the principle of least surprise.
Yes.
Which is when you upgrade, nothing changes.
Yeah, it should be the same.
So, but this is one thing that is turned on. You can actually turn it off because, you know, as with any kind of compression, the actual amount of compression you get, in other words, what's your compression ratio, depends on what the data is that you're compressing.
Right.
So if your log records are doing lots of little tiny updates, then it's probably not going to compress very well. If your log records are inserting large amounts of data, large amounts of, say, blob data, then it probably will compress. But, you know, if you upgrade to 2008 and you find that you're using more CPU because of the compression database mirroring, you can turn it off. It's a documented trace flag 1462 turns off log stream compression. discussion.
I'm always disturbed that you rip those numbers out like that there, Mr. Random.
Yeah, Kimberly knows the she knows the KB articles, although I'm starting to learn them as well. But 328551, that's concerning trace flag 1118 in TempDB in 2000. I always say she needs to get out more since she battles these off in a class.
Walk us through a transaction with a file stream. So we literally can roll back. I mean, all of those effects will work right down on these files as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is no limitation.
And it's just making that's why it's making copies of the file, so it can always roll back.
Yep.
Or roll forward.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Let me tell you some more interactions with other features, okay?
Sure.
Database snapshots. So you can create a database snapshot on a database that has file stream in it, but the file stream data won't be snapped. Okay?
Okay.
The database snapshot is only at the SQL level, not at the file system level. Okay? Which means that you can get in and play around with your database snapshot, but you're not going to be able to access the file stream data. What that also means is you're not going to be able to do one of the cool things you can do with snapshots, which is revert to snapshots. Okay? Database snapshots let you take this point-in-time image of the database, and if something goes wrong with your database, you can say, okay, I want to revert back to that point in time. And it will essentially restore the database from the snapshot. If you have file stream data in your database, you can't do that anymore.
So it won't work for the regular data either?
It won't work for the regular. Yeah, you just cannot revert to snapshot if your database has file stream in it.
So they disabled the feature. But that's an interesting consequence. Again, you know, a price of using file stream is if you love your database snapshot feature, it's broken.
Yeah. So I mentioned clustering earlier on. If you're going to use failover clustering,
right,
then make sure that wherever you put the file stream data container is on shared storage.
Yeah.
So that when the failover happens, the other node can still see it.
Just the same as the regular database. And so you're under the same constraints.
That's about it. Oh, here's a really cool one. SQL Express has a 4 gigabyte database size limit.
Yes.
But that doesn't include file stream.
Oh, okay.
Ah.
So you can have, this is going to be good for developers. You can have this little application built on top of SQL Express and ship as much file stream data as you want or store as much file stream data as you want.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's an interesting choice.
Yeah.
And, very cool.
Apart from those things, it basically works with everything else. You know, there's a few foibles with partitioning, there's some foibles with replication, but they're pretty well documented in Sidebooks Online.
Yeah, I was thinking about that replication would be an interesting challenge under the scenario, too.
You can actually replicate file stream. You can choose to replicate the data with or without the file stream attribute. Because I guess one thing I haven't mentioned is, you know, how do you define a file stream column? A file stream column is basically a var binary max column that you add the word file stream onto. Okay.
So there's no data type called file stream.
It's kind of funky. There's no column type called file stream. It's a var binary max file stream column.
But you add the word file stream onto the name of the column.
Yeah.
That's it.
You know, yeah. It's kind of funky. So so you'd actually do a create table with table name and your column name space var binary max space file stream. So it's just appended on the end of the data type.
That and SQL Server's watching for that and treats it differently.
Yep.
Interesting.
So, you know what? One thing I didn't say about setting up FileStream is there's a funky process for actually installing FileStream on your system. And this changed through the various CTPs of SQL Server 2008. What they have in RTM is as follows. There is a split between installing on the box itself and installing in SQL Server. Because using file stream involves defining a share name and installing a file system filter driver, that is not something that somebody who is only a SQL admin should be able to do to a box.
Sure.
That is what the box admin has to do. Okay, so there is a kind of separation of duties thing between the box admin and the SQL admin. So the box admin, at the time of installing SQL Server, or after the fact using the SQL Configuration Manager, has to go and say, allow this instance to use file stream. In other words, stick the filter driver in there. And then inside SQL Server, the SQL Server admin has to enable file stream as well with an SP configure option. So there's a kind of two-stage process.
Okay. Yeah, because it requires different sets of permissions, really.
Different sets of permissions, yeah.
And we talk about the NTFS configuration. I can also see in a large organization, at least the DBA, going to a server admin and saying, oh, and while you're at it, I need you to set up these drives this way.
Absolutely.
So that is a whole set of steps independent of what would typically a database guy need to do.
And that's, you know, I said I wrote this 30-page white paper, and a full one-third of the white paper is about setting up your system for FileStream.
Right.
Going through, I mean, it talks all the different things that I've said in the show today, it has a bunch more information about them. So it's very important that when you do choose to use FileStream that you set your system up properly. Otherwise, you are not going to see the performance that you're going to expect.
Not that anyone's really going to know what to expect out of FileStream anyway, but we are shooting for as fast as if the SQL Server wasn't involved at all.
That's the idea.
Right.
All the power of SQL Server without the overhead, yeah.
Yeah, without the overheads. But, you know, unless you do things like disabling 8.3 name generation and setting up NTFS properly, you're going to start to hit these scalability limits of NTFS, you know, when it hasn't been configured for high performance, high scalability.
Paul, you mentioned the PaaS, I think you're talking about the PaaS Community Summit that's coming up pretty soon. Well, why don't you go ahead and talk a little bit about that and what PaaS is also, because people who are interested in this topic certainly could probably use to know.
PaaS is a volunteer-run organization. It's kind of an umbrella professional association over a bunch of user groups for SQL Server. A bunch of user groups are affiliated with PaaS, and PaaS is probably most well-known for having this yearly conference called the PaaS Community Summit. And there's usually one in Europe, and the main one is in the U.S., and it moves around from year to year. And this year, it happens to be in Seattle. So they do a bunch of pre-conferences and then a few days of sessions and longer spotlight sessions. So you know, this year, Kimberly and I are doing a pre-con on database maintenance for the involuntary DBA, which we talked about in the last show.
Right,
and
that should be fun.
I'm doing a, we're both going to do a spotlight session on recovering from corruption. So there's a session that I did at TechEd where I create all kinds of nasty corrupt databases and then show what CheckDB is going to show you in terms of the errors, how you go about recovering from those, reattaching suspect databases. So we're going to do all kinds of nasty things and demo them and talk about them. So, and, you know, a whole bunch of people are going to be there, lots of MVPs, lots of Microsoft people. So, you know, it's the place to be.
It looks like this is really for anybody who touches SQL Server, whether it's
people,
a DBA or if you write applications that use SQL Server or all of the above. Yeah,
there's it does developer and IT pro. There's also another one in Vegas the week before, the Connections Conference, which Kimberly and I co-chair, which is, again, a large SQL Server conference, but it also has co-located developer conference as well. So that's very cool for developers that are wanting to learn more about SQL Server and managing SQL Server.
I expect we'll be there as well.
We're going to be there as well. Well, we're always there. And we're going to be doing two pre-cons there. One on, again, the involuntary DBA, and also another one on using new features in 2005 and 2008 to manage a relational data warehouse.
Cool.
I like this concept of talking around the topic of the involuntary DBA. There's an awful lot of those out there. So.
Yeah, I mean, as we said last time, there's so many people out there, and the cool thing is there's so much for people to learn. And as you may know, I love blogging. I'm a prolific blogger, so I love throwing out all kinds of, you know, hints and tips and tricks and how things work and stuff for, you know, to help these guys out, as well as the people that are more advanced and know more about the internals.
Right. I guess finally, toss out the blog address. Go ahead and say it so people can start typing.
www.sqlskills.com/blog/Paul.
There you go.
Or just search for Paul Randall on Live Search or Google.
And you'll find
him. My blog is called In Recovery.
Yes, you are.
The joke is I'm in recovery from being at Microsoft.
The 12 steps of something involved
12
here, I'm sure.
12 steps of something, yes.
That's right.
Yeah. And Kimberly blogs there as well. In fact, Kimberly has just turned over a new leaf, she says, and she has been blogging like a crazy person since the weekend.
That's awesome.
Yeah. She doesn't blog as much as I do, but she blogs long, intense, involved blog posts that have just as much information. Very cool, actually, the amount of free information there is on our blogs and on just blogs in general that MVPs and other folks do.
For sure. Paul Randall, thanks so much for coming on the show.
You are so welcome.
And we'll see you next week on Run As Radio.